Well, good morning and happy Easter. It's great to be here. Wish the rest of you were here as well. But that day will come. Well, this morning I was up early as I usually am on Sundays. I get up probably between 4:30 and 5 o'clock most Sunday mornings to finish getting ready, to get my heart ready, get my mind wrapped around what we're going to be talking about today. And I checked my weather app, and it said that the sunrise was going to be at 6:42. So on impulse, around 6:30, I jumped into my car, and I drove down to Forest Lawn, and had my own little personal Easter sunrise service there, standing by the graves of my parents, and then later by my brother-in-law, Vince. Now, as I stood there, I thought a couple things. I mean, a lot of things went through my mind as I stood there facing east and watching the sun rise. Tried to put myself in the disciples or in Jesus' time, that how shocked I would be if all of a sudden somebody showed up outside that grave, and it was my dad or somebody and greeted me. I'd probably die and jump into the grave. It would have been a great shock. I don't think we always kind of grasp that. We get so familiar with the resurrection story that it was so unusual, it was so out of the ordinary. We know about it that it's hard for us to kind of go back into the experience of those who were there on that first Sunday morning, that first Easter, when they met Jesus outside the tomb and then later on in their lives, and how hard it was to actually kind of wrap their minds and their hearts around, is this really Jesus? Are we really seeing a real person here? Is this a ghost? Is this an apparition? Is this a vision? So many things must have gone through their minds at that time, and I think it took a while for it to sink in that yes, Jesus was alive. But the resurrection for us is also a day that we have to celebrate and recognize that in the resurrection, we have great hope. So as I stood there, I listened to a song. I was raised on Southern gospel music, so I listened to a song by the Cathedrals, actually written by the Gaithers, called Then Came the Morning. Now you got to say that a lot of Southern gospel music, the theology is very suspect. But this song was really so powerful, and as I sat there, I my heart filled with hope. At the same time as my eyes filled with tears, and some of the lyrics that caught my attention and just gripped my heart was, "Then came the morning, night turned into day, shadows vanished before the sun." Death had lost, and life had won, for morning had come. There's a lot of people who discredit or disregard the resurrection today, and even some of those who claim to be followers of Jesus. A number of years ago, I read an article in the Vancouver Sun by somebody who was top leader of the Anglican Church, who said he no longer believed in the physical resurrection of Jesus. And I thought, That didn't make sense and it didn't add up to me. Because the words of Paul that come to mind where he writes in 1 Corinthians 15, he says, "If Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. You are still in your sins. Then those who believe and have fallen asleep in Christ are lost. If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are to be pitied more than all men. But Christ has indeed been raised from the dead. He is risen." The hope that we have is that no matter how long the night that we may be enduring or experiencing in our life at any particular time, morning will be coming. And that's something to hold on to. Now, admittedly, sometimes the night that we are enduring or experiencing is a night of our own making. And that kind of leads me into my opening question here today that you find in your outlines and your notes. And that is this. Have you ever felt like a total and complete failure? Like you've blown it so bad that there's just absolutely no way back and no way to move forward in the life that you had imagined and hoped for. I'm not talking about, you know, those mistakes and failures and flaws that are kind of the everyday, ordinary kind, but those major things that can happen at times, a willful decision that we sometimes make that lead us in the wrong direction and are result in the total ruin of our lives. Often, even in the face of great advice and counsel of others, we just totally disregard it. Perhaps you're on a job or working on a project and you made a huge mistake on it, even though you were told not to go that way, and it basically killed the whole project and you lost your job over that, and perhaps lost your whole career in that area and any hope of getting any kind of advancement in your life in that area. Perhaps an investment that you made, hoping to make it rich, making it big, that went south on you and went the wrong direction. And it ended up, instead of a great financial gain, ended up a great financial loss or even bankruptcy. Relationships, marriages, friendships, they fall apart sometimes and often because one of the parties makes a critical mistake or error in judgment, has an affair, moves off in a different direction, starts building into the relationship, and the end is a painful breakup that not only affects the couple but often the kids that are also involved at the same time. What about you as parents? You know, we make mistakes along the way, but sometimes our children, regardless of how well or how much we've built into lives, can make decisions that take them the wrong direction in life and cause ruin in their lives. And what they don't often realize is they drag us through the mud with them. There is really nothing that is personal or private that does not affect other people. We don't always own up to that. That our failures are not only affect us deeply, but often those around us. Over the time, I've seen two very common responses to these failures that take place, these times where we've absolutely blown it in life and kind of lost everything. One is simply to throw it all away, to basically give up on life, to walk away and just abandon any hope at all. And if you go down to the area of Maine and Hastings, there are countless stories down there that if you took the time to simply sit and listen to people, there are countless stories of riches to rags there before you. I heard one just recently, a couple of days ago, of a person who went that direction and now is finding her way back, but in the past, at one point, had owned several very prominent restaurants, had been very significant in the whole hospitality and food industry. But because the prevalence of alcohol had taken to drinking and eventually it consumed her, and she found herself at one point in the back seat of a car dying of alcohol poisoning. Someplace along the way, God met her at her lowest point, and she was able to find enough strength to dial 911, was picked up by the paramedics who told her, you're dying. And somehow made it through that and went through the recovery process. It was now investing her life back into the lives of those who were in the same place that she had been at one time. But there's many down there that never find that way out. They have given up on life. That is their life. I just took a drive through there yesterday at a point where I was up, just needed to get out and think. And it just took me back to old times. And I thought, there's just so many people here who've totally lost hope in life. And that is one way of responding to absolute failure. The other one, and I suspect that this is the one that more often than not apply in their lives, and that is they simply give up any hope of achieving any kind of great potential lives, but they're going to make the best out of it. They're not going to become the worst person they can be over here. They're not going to succumb to addictions or anything else over here. But they've given up on anything that resembled any of their hopes and dreams at one point, and they settle for kind of a mediocre kind of drifting through life, considering themselves, in a sense, damaged goods beyond being able to go farther than where they are right now. I think there's a lot of people in their journey of faith that will find themselves in that same place. They will say, well, we've tried it, it didn't work for us. It may work for you, it may work for us, but it just simply didn't work for us. And perhaps they found a difficulty in making the full sense of commitment to being a follower of Jesus, everything that's involved with it. It occurs to me as we come to Easter that we often want to bypass Good Friday. We want to bypass the cross and we want to get to the celebration of the resurrection. And we fail to realize that without a death on the cross, there can be no resurrection. And the same thing applies to our life in our journey with Jesus. If there is no dying to self, where Jesus said, if you want to follow me, you must take up your cross, you must deny yourself, and then follow me. We want to get to the new life that God offers us through the resurrection, but we want to bypass the dying to self part, and it doesn't work. Without a death, there can be no resurrection. There can be no new life in Jesus. But I watch people over the years that have been in ministry. They've been actively involved at times, trying to do the right things, trying to put all the effort out, usually on their own strength. And it's not working out. And then eventually they just pack it in and they throw in the towel and they walk away from it all. Others keep on trying, but it becomes simply a religious ritual with no deep heartfelt experience of the presence of God. So here's the question that I want to deal with today. That is, how does God respond? What does He think when you feel like an absolute failure? How does God respond or react? How do you think He's responding and react to you when you've blown it badly in your life, whether it be in your personal life, in your work life, or in your spiritual life? These things are all kind of come together. What I want to tell you here is that the good news here is that even when you may have given up on yourself, and even when others may have given up on you and written you off, God does not give up on you. God has not given up on you, regardless of where you are right now in your journey through life. And I want to turn to the Bible here and look at the example that comes out of the life of Peter. And we'll be looking at John chapter 21. You might want to start looking there, but as you do, just a brief review of Peter's life, the ups and downs of his life as a follower of Jesus. See, Peter was one of Jesus' first disciples. He was actually seems to be the first one Jesus actually called, because he's walking along the Sea of Galilee, along the lake shore, and he sees Peter and Andrew cleaning out their nets, and he says, "Come, follow me, and I will make you." And they do, and they leave everything, and they follow him. He became part of this inner circle of Jesus' closest disciples, his closest friends, along with James and John. And as such, they had the privilege of being part of this inner circle with Jesus and seeing things that the others didn't necessarily see, being invited in to witness things that others didn't witness. When Jesus raises Jairus' daughter, who was given as dead, had died, when Jesus enters into the home, he leaves everybody else outside, but he takes Peter and James and John with him. When he's getting towards the end of his life, he takes Peter, James, and John up on the mountainside where he prays. And while he's praying, he's transfigured, the scriptures tell us. And he begins to glow a little bit. And now there before them appear Elijah and Moses. And they have this conversation with Jesus about how the next little while part of his life is going to take place in his death and his exit from this world. They were witnesses to that. On the very last night, when Jesus, just before Jesus was arrested, when Jesus goes off on his own to pray, he takes Peter, James, and John with him. So Peter has been part of this inner circle. He's been privileged to see, be an intimate friend to Jesus himself. Now, Peter was brash and outspoken. He was a bit arrogant, a little bit rough around the edges. He seemed to have been a somewhat self-appointed spokesperson for the rest of the disciples. Whenever Jesus answered a question, he was one of the first ones to blurt out a reply. He was one of these guys that acted first and spoke first and thought later. Some of you can identify with that. We can see different kind of things of his actions along the way. So they're out on this boat, on their boat, and the sea is really stormy. And they look across the water, and there's Jesus walking towards them on the water. And he says, "Jesus, if that's you, can it call me over to you?" And Jesus said, "Well, you come on over." And he gets out, and he actually starts to try to walk on the water. Now the smart 11 stayed in the boat. They realized they didn't have enough faith to do that. Peter doesn't last too long at that. He's the first to answer Jesus when he's taking them off on the side. And he says, "Who do the people say I am? And who do you say I am?" He kind of blurts out the right answer, but very obviously doesn't own it exactly the way he says it, because in a few minutes later, he's rebuking Jesus because Jesus begins to tell them about his impending death. He vehemently denies at the Last Supper when they're meeting around the meal, when Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me and the rest of you are going to abandon me. He vehemently denies that he would be one of those, and he swears, even though the rest of these guys over here, they leave you and abandon you, he says, "I will stay with you and I will die with you." When Jesus is being arrested, he's the one that pulls out a sword. Some versions say it was really only a fishing knife. I don't know what he was planning to do that against a bunch of Roman soldiers. And he cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant. He was brash. He acted without thinking. He spoke without thinking. But when push came to shove in the life of his master and his good friend Jesus, when Jesus had been arrested and was being held in the courtyard and had been beaten already, Peter absolutely denies knowing him. Significant that this event is recorded in all four gospel accounts. All four record Peter's denial of Jesus. You can remember or can go back over the scene perhaps. He's there, he's kind of followed, you know, at a distance when Jesus was arrested. And then he goes into the courtyard where Jesus is being held. And he's trying to stay unobtrusive and hidden, but it's a cold night. And so he approaches this fire of coals that is burning in front of him, and others are warming himself, and he proceeds to warm himself. And first the servant girl comes up and says, "I know you. You're one of them." And he denies, "No, I'm not. I don't know this guy." And two more times as he's there in front of that fire warming himself, he denies and even calls down curses on himself if he would be telling a lie. He vehemently denies knowing Jesus. Fulfilling what Jesus had told him, that before the rooster, the cock crows three times, you will have denied me. Crows, you will have denied me three times. And after the third time, we're told that the rooster crows, and right at that point, Jesus turns and looks at him. And that look must have just melted his heart, and he must have died a million deaths inside, because he takes off and he weeps bitterly over that. There's a contrast here that we can easily overlook between how Peter and how Judas handled their total failures or absolute failures as followers of Jesus where they've totally blown it. Judas throws everything away. He sees himself beyond redemption. And he goes out and he hangs himself when he realizes how badly, how much he's blown it, how where he failed. Peter, on the other hand, he doesn't do that. But I think in essence here, as we look at our text today and look at him, I think Peter writes himself off as a follower of Jesus. He sees himself as no longer having a place with the other followers, the other disciples, or a place in God's purpose in the world. Even after he sees Jesus resurrected from the dead, even after he's met with him the first couple of times, I don't think Peter kind of wraps his heart and mind around. He perhaps understands that Jesus cares for him, has forgiven him, and he's okay with that. But he doesn't quite own the fact that he isn't damaged goods, that he has a place and a purpose in God's plan for this world. Until he has this healing encounter with Jesus that is recorded in John chapter 21, and that's what I'm going to look at today as we go through this. I want to go through that and look at the experience of Peter and see where we can apply this to our own lives as well. John chapter 21. As we get into this, I want to say, I'm going to in many ways set my notes aside here. I've given you notes, and often the notes I come up with are simply more often for you to be able to follow up on things on your own, especially when we're studying a particular text that may bring some meaning or significance out to you when you review that text on your own at some time. Like some of you, I've gone through my experience of wandering far from God, and I've lived this text. And as I've reviewed it, I'm amazed and awed once again at God's awesome love and his grace and mercy that is always there for us. John chapter 21. In many ways, when you reach the end of John chapter 20, and we had that text read for us earlier, the last couple of verses of chapter 20 read for us, it feels like John has wrapped up his whole gospel account, that he's brought it into a landing, and he's brought it to a conclusion. So when we get into chapter 21, it feels like kind of like Columbo does. Have you ever watched those Columbo movies? You know, Columbo's about ready to walk out, and he says, just one more thing. And usually that's where the clincher comes in, and he has something that he's going to question or say to the person who's actually guilty of whatever crime has been committed. And I think John here is saying, he's wrapped up his whole account of the ministry of Jesus. He's told you that this is all written down for you to believe in him as the Son of God. And then he says, just one more thing I need to add on. And what chapter 21 becomes is kind of like an epilogue to his gospel account, much like chapter 1, the first part of chapter 1 is a prologue to what he was going to come. And I think chapter 21, in a sense, summarizes everything that Jesus' ministry is all about, which is about restoring people, restoring our relationship with God and our relationship with him. And I think this is particularly even significant to even John, because Peter was his good friend from childhood. They had grown up together. They had probably gone to school together. They were fishing buddies. They worked together on John and James on their father Zebedee's boat. And Peter seems to have had his own boat, but maybe inherited it from his own dad. And they had been in the whole fishing industry together. They had worked together all their lives. I think there was a bit of a competitive edge between these two good friends. They were actually very different in personality and character, but I think there was a competitive edge, because when John tells us about Mary of Magdalene coming back to them and saying, you know, the tomb is empty, I don't know what they've done with the body of Jesus, it's gone. Both Peter and John proceed to run to the tomb. Now remember, this is John recording this, and John says, but I got there first. Now he got there first. But it says Peter went in first. See, that was the difference between these two men. John was a very thoughtful kind of person. He was cautious about some things. Peter acted without thinking. And so Peter gets there last, but he goes in first. John waits. And we're going to see a little bit here in this chapter, again, a particular difference between these two men when they react and respond to seeing and recognizing Jesus on the shore. But John begins by saying afterwards. Literally, actually, he says after these things, and he's pointing back to the things that he's just told us about in chapter 20, about the empty tomb, about Jesus showing up to Mary Magdalene, about Jesus coming into their midst when they were there without Thomas being present, and then when he showed up again with Thomas being there. He's talked about how all these events after these things took place. He says Jesus appeared again. In other words, one more time. We know that he appeared again after that another time to his disciples. He says, by the Sea of Tiberias. Now, Tiberias is simply another name for the Sea of Galilee that John uses because he would have been familiar with it. When he says Jesus appeared, he's saying that Jesus made himself visible. He manifested himself. He showed himself to us here at the Sea of Galilee. And then he says it happened this way. He says, Simon Peter, Thomas, called Didymus, Nathanael, from Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, that would have been John and his brother James, and two other disciples who he forgets to name, were together. I want to stop there for a minute. What do you do? What do you do when life is falling apart? What do you do when all of a sudden everything that you've been putting, you're giving your life to, comes to an abrupt end? Think of some of, I think this would apply to some of you, think of having lost your job or having your job actually come to be closed off or at least laid off because of COVID, because of the pandemic. And so back last in March, there were a lot of people that were simply sent home and said, there's no work for you. And everything that you've been working for, everything that you've done, given your life to for a period of time, is now is absolutely coming to end. It's a little bit where these seven disciples are at. For the last 3 years, they have been spending their lives pretty much 24/7 with Jesus, following him around, listening to his teaching, witnessing the miracles that he was doing, then sent out to do the same themselves. They had their hopes pinned on Jesus as being the Messiah, but a Messiah in a different way than he came to be a Messiah. They had their hopes pinned on Jesus being the Messiah that was going to once again establish Israel as a free nation, not under the rule of Rome, but a free nation under the rule of God. When Jesus died on the cross, for them, that all came to an abrupt end. Life, the way they had known it, for the last 3 years, and everything that they'd poured their lives into, everything they had been eating, sleeping, drinking, listening to, and doing in their life was now out of the question. It was no more. It was like, what did we do that for? It's like it didn't amount to anything. It didn't lead up to what they expected. They did what so many of us do. They go home. Or they go to a place where they can find some solitude, some comfort, they want to go to a familiar environment. And what is more familiar to some fishermen in that day than the lake, than the beach, on the Sea of Galilee? And so they're there by the Sea of Galilee, the Sea of Tiberias, as John puts it. And they're just hanging out. I don't think they're there waiting for Jesus to show up. I don't think they have any expectations at all. For them, life, the future has lost any expectation. They can't see into the future. It's like that's just non-existent right now for them. And they're just simply hanging out as a group of buddies, just not knowing what else to do with their lives. And in this setting, in the middle of this, Peter says, I'm going fishing. I'm going fishing, Peter tells them. And they said, oh, I will go with you. It's like, we got nothing better to do, okay? So we'll just go out with you. I don't think Peter said, I'm going fishing just to fill time. I don't think he was going fishing to be like a sports fisherman and just kind of have fun doing it. He was a commercial fisherman. I think when Peter says, I'm going fishing, I'm going to go fish, I think Peter's looking back on his life. He's saying, that part of my life is over. And even if there's some kind of future there, I don't have any part of it because I simply blew it so badly with Jesus. I simply don't see any way clear to how I can be part of anything else that's going to happen here. I got to go back to what I know what to do. I know how to fish. I've been a commercial fisherman. I'm going back to my old life. You see, he's not over here. He's not throwing it all away. He's not going to just kind of go off into some kind of addiction, some kind of alcoholic stupor. He's not throwing his life away here. But he's saying, I can't live up to the potential that I once had as part of the kingdom of God, as part of what Jesus is planning, his mission, whatever that's going to look like now. I don't see how that can be possible. I don't see where. So I'm going to go over here and just simply do what I know how to do. John says, so they went out and got into the boat. And it seems that they were fishing all night. That in itself is an indication that they weren't out there just for the fun. I mean, any fishermen out there? I've gone fishing, and after you've been out on the lake 2 or 3 hours and, you know, there's no fish biting, you just kind of say, I think we'll call it a night, and we'll go home and go to sleep. They're out all night. And at the end of the night, it says they caught nothing. Let me just stop there for a minute. I'm not saying that this is something John is teaching here, but it's something that does come to my mind. You see, often when we veer off the track, off the route that God has called us to, because someplace along the way we may have blown it, we've kind of given up on ourselves. God has not given up on us, remember that. But we've given up on ourselves, and we see ourselves as no longer having a viable part to play in anything significant. We go back to what we know how to do. We just simply say, I'm going to do this. And sometimes it just doesn't pan out. It doesn't work. Here's a word of warning. If what you're doing isn't working for you, maybe, just maybe, God has something else for you. If what you're doing is not working, if your life is not working out the way you're living it, the way you're doing it, just maybe God has something else. But you know what we do instead? We work harder. We just put more time into it. We get caught up in the busyness of just digging deeper and working harder and giving ourselves more to something that's not working. I have also become convinced that often busyness in our lives, and if this applies to you, if the shoe fits, wear it, okay? Sometimes the busyness in our lives is simply to cover up the hurts that we haven't been able to find a way of dealing with of past. Sometimes the busyness in life is a way that we block out the voice of God speaking into our lives. Sometimes the busyness is a way of just setting ourselves, protecting ourselves from those relationships from which we've been hurt in the past or experienced discomfort or not things haven't worked out. And we so easily get caught up in that sort of thing. And in the process, we miss out on what God is trying to speak into our lives because we just dig deeper, we're stubborn, we drive harder, we work harder, we're longer, we put more hours in, we fill our schedules up more, and we never have the time for what we've been talking about earlier, towards solitude and silence and prayer, to hear, to stop, to slow down, to stop and say, am I doing the right thing, God? Am I going about it the right way? These guys fish all night and they catch nothing. So early in the morning, it says Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus. I'm not thinking that this is just some spiritual block of their eyes necessarily. I think, one, it's early morning. If you've been out on a lake someplace in BC, we have lots of lakes, and you've been fishing out there, and you're out there early morning, you know that the light isn't all that great, especially if the sun is just barely coming up. And you don't necessarily discern or distinguish somebody who's standing about 100 yards or better away from you, because that's what they, apparently that's how far they were from shore, or close they were to shore. And maybe there's that morning mist, that morning fog that kind of floats across the lake, that kind of rises as the sun comes up, as the sun brings out the moisture and creates that fog over it. So I'm not going to get down on them too hard here at first for not recognizing that is Jesus on the shore. They don't realize it's him, but he calls out to them. And when he calls out to them, it's really interesting because he says, friends, actually, it's a diminutive, it says children, and that was little boys. But actually, it's an expression that would be similar to kind of what the British sometimes use, lads. Hey, lads. Hey, guys. He says, haven't you any fish? He's already giving them the answer. He's already presuming they haven't caught anything. But the word for fish that he's using there isn't even for, like, do you have a big catch of fish, or do you have even a whole fish? But do you have any bits and pieces of fish that we can actually cook up and eat? Do you have anything to eat? And they simply answer no. To which he says, well, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you'll find some. I think there could be a tendency to say, why would they follow the directions of this guy on the shore who they don't know who he is? But I think at this point in time, they may be thinking he's just another fisherman. And fishermen are great at giving each other advice in terms of how to catch, and especially when you're not catching. They say, well, you should do it this way. You should go to this place. You'll catch more over there. In an earlier part of my life, my non-Jesus days, I lived for about 2 months on the beaches of Tobago. Thought I'd kind of died and gone to heaven myself. It was paradise. One of the things that we realized is that there was a fisherman there who had his boat and his crew, and they had the life of that I would have loved to have. I mean, they worked hard when they worked hard, but they spent a good part of the day just sitting on the beach watching the water. Now, to me, I look out at the ocean, I look at the water, it looks like water to me, you know. But they could tell by just minute changes in color on the water whether the fish were running, what size of the fish were coming in. And then at the right point, they said, okay, no, those are bait fish coming in. Those are the small ones. Wait a little longer. Oh, yeah, now there come the bigger fish. Now we go out, and they would row out in a semicircle, and we'd pull in the net the same. And it would take about 2 or 3 hours of hard work because it's playing tug-of-war with the sea, and you would pull it in. I say that because I think when you're out in the boat, you don't necessarily see things as clearly as somebody from the shore does who says, and they just think, oh, he sees the fact that the fish are running on that side of the boat. Let's go throw it in on that side of the boat. They do. And it says when they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Now, about this time, okay, about this time, the light should have been going on in Peter's mind and his heart and his life. It should have been a little bit of a callback to a previous experience when he was first called by Jesus, where Luke tells us that he had been fishing all night with his brother Andrew, and they'd had caught absolutely nothing. Jesus comes along and says, can I get on your boat to preach because the crowds are kind of pressing in? And he gave his boat, allowed Jesus to use his boat as a platform. And then when Jesus is finished, he tells Peter, he says, I'll push out and let's go fishing. To which Peter says, you know, I've been fishing all night. You're a carpenter, you're a rabbi. You stick to what you know what to do. I'll stick to what I know. It's pointless. But Jesus said, let's go out. And he says, okay, if you say so, Jesus. And he goes out, and there it says they caught so many that the nets were breaking. So the light should have been going on here in Peter's mind. But notice that it's John, and he refers to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved, said to Peter, it is the Lord. John provides the insight, but as we read on, we see Peter, in his classical fashion, provides the instant action without thinking too much. Because as soon as Simon Peter heard him say, "It is the Lord," he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he had taken it off. He's hard at work out there. And he jumps into the water. The other disciples, John notes, followed in the boat. If he wants to get wet and get cold and swim in, have at it, but we're only about 100 yards from shore. We'll row in. Thank you very much. And they get to shore. And when they land, it says, John says, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. In other words, Jesus really didn't need the fish that they had. But he did say, "Bring some of the fish you just caught." And Simon Peter drags it over and it's full of large fish, 153. I'm not too sure about the significance of the number. I have all kinds of suppositions, but that calls for mathematics and mental gymnastics that I don't think apply. But it says, "But even with so many, the net was not torn." Jesus provides breakfast for them. And then after the breakfast, he has this conversation with Peter. Now, I just want to back this up just for a minute to what John says. When they come ashore, they see a fire of burning coals. Now, we can easily pass that by and think, yeah, he had a little campfire, he was cooking the fish, and see nothing more in it than that. But John is this master of hidden meanings and double meanings intended in the things that he writes about. And if we would have been reading the Gospel of John in his original language or listening to it being read for us or spoken to us, our ears would have heard something that was said just a couple of chapters ago in chapter 18, where, remember, Peter walks into the courtyard and he warms his hands, and John uses the very same term, a fire of burning coals. There are only two times in Scripture that that particular expression, that particular word is used. I think there's a significance here. I think there's a particular significance because I think Jesus is intentionally recreating a scene for Peter through which he wants to walk Peter back through the experience that he had where he denied Jesus. And he's going to give Peter that opportunity to redeem himself in the sense. And through that process, Jesus is going to restore that relationship with him. Again, understand that it was Peter needed to see himself restored. Jesus was already open to the relationship. As far as Jesus was concerned, he still loved Peter. He still welcomed him into his friendship, into the work that he was about. But Peter needed to hear that and understand that, just like you and I at times need to go through that experience in order to come into that sense of being restored, that full sense of redemption, that our life has value, that we have purpose, and there's meaning to what we're doing. And so Jesus, after the meal is finished, he turns to Simon Peter, and he says, "Simon, son of John." He uses his full name. Now, I don't know about you, when I'm called by my full name, I'm thinking I'm in trouble. But I don't think Jesus is saying that to Simon. I don't think he's saying, "You're in trouble here." But he wants to address him and say, "I have something serious to talk to you about." And he says, "Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these?" And again, here we come into, I think, is a classic example of John's double meaning, because more than these, it's a comparison. It could be more than these other guys over here. Remember Simon? Remember Peter? Not too long ago, right after we had that meal together, we were kind of going out to the garden, and you said, "Even if they abandon you, I will never abandon you." In other words, I love you more than these. So it could be that Jesus is saying, do you really love me more than these? I also think, and perhaps even more significant, I also think Jesus is pointing to his nets, his boat, and this big catch. Do you love me more than a successful career in human terms as a commercial fisherman? Are you willing to leave that behind just like you did when you first answered my call to follow me back 3 years ago? Do you love me more than these? I think the same question is being asked about you and me. Not do we love Jesus more than somebody else, because Jesus isn't into comparing our love with others unless we've compared ourselves. Really? I think he's more into saying, do you love me more than you love your life over here, your self-centered life that is built around you, that is about getting, accumulating what you want in life? Do you love me more than that? What would be your answer? Peter's answer is interesting because he doesn't really answer the question. He says, Lord, you know that I love you. I personally think it's significant that he didn't say, Lord, you know I love you more than these. Because I think at this point, Peter's not willing to say that. Jesus accepts us in our honesty, in our unwillingness to say those things. What is wrong, problematic, is sometimes when we say, yes, I love you more than these, but we never live that out in our lives. Now, eventually we got to get past that. But the real issue, the real question of our lives is, do you love me more than all of this that you could have apart from serving me? Are you willing to set that aside? Again, Jesus comes back to him a second time. Simon, son of John, do you truly love me? Like, now it isn't a comparison with anything else, but he's picking up on the fact that Peter has answered, yes, I love you, but doesn't say I love you more than these. And so he's saying, now he's digging a little bit deeper into Peter's life and saying, okay, forget all the other things. Dig deep into your heart, look deep into your heart and say, do you truly love me? Peter's answer is, well, yes, you know that I love you. Same as he did the first time. And just like Jesus answered the first time, he refers to something he needs to do. In other words, if you really love me, he says, like, feed my lambs. In other words, commit your life to taking care of my sheep. And here he says, take care of my sheep. You see, the way we live out and demonstrate our love for God is not in the words that we say. It's easy to gather for worship and sing songs of praise and sing, I love you, Lord, and all those sorts of nice things. That's great. But love is demonstrated not through our words, but through our actions and how we live. How we spend our time, how we spend our money, how we spend our lives, what we commit our lives to, what is central to our lives will determine, will tell God volumes about how much you love him. Then Jesus turns to him a third time and says, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Well, Peter's hurt now because Jesus had asked him a third time. I think it would be easy to say, but I don't hear Jesus saying this. I hear Jesus speaking in a very gentle tone of voice, gentle, kind voice. It'd be easy to hear him saying, Peter, are you sure you love me? You know, a few days ago, it didn't look like it. You know, a few days ago, that back there where you warming yourself by fire, just like this one, you said you denied knowing me. But that's not what Jesus is getting at. That's not Jesus' way of of approaching him. He's not rubbing Peter's nose in his failure to own up to knowing him in the past. He's getting Peter to own up to what's deep inside his own heart. Because we can say the right words and not have them coming from the heart. And he's asking Peter, peel back a few layers there, Peter. Do you really love me? And now Peter says, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. To which Jesus says, feed my sheep. There's a couple things going on here. There's a restoring process that's going on because as Jesus walks Peter through three times being asked the same question, he's in front of this coal, this fire of burning coals. He's getting Peter a chance to relive the experience. As painful as that might have been, as painful as that was for Peter right now, he's getting him to relive that experience so that in the process he can say, I still have a purpose for your life. He's not only restoring him, he's repurposing his life where he says, I have a purpose, feed my lambs, tend my sheep, look after my sheep. Then he goes on to say, I tell you the truth. When you were younger, you dressed yourself and you went where you wanted, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. It says Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. There's a cost. There's a cost to following Jesus. And what he's laying it out, this isn't the bait and switch that Jesus is throwing in front of Peter. He's not saying, you know, you're all forgiven, you're restored, you got a place in my kingdom, here's a position of leadership, have at it. He's saying, come and take this on. But this goes with the territory of it. Then he says to Peter, follow me. In other words, come and be my apprentice. Learn from me again. He's saying, and I won't be around here, but the Holy Spirit will come. Learn from me. Live out my calling in your life. Now Peter does what so many of us do at those points. Because Peter turns and he sees, you know, I imagine what's been happening is Peter's been walking along the shore of the Lake Galilee with Jesus, and Jesus has been questioning as they walked along, and Peter turns around and he sees John following behind, perhaps not real close, but just behind. And remember, Jesus just told him what kind of life or what kind of end, actually death awaits him if he chooses to follow him and to take on this purpose, this task that he's giving him about being one of his caretakers of his flock, his sheep. And he says, well, what about him? Okay, so that's what I have to do, but what about him? Isn't that so much like us? We want to make sure that somebody else has to pay some kind of price too along the way. Jesus' answer to him is the same one I think he would give us. If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? So in other words, you know what happens in John's life is none of your business. You must follow me. I think what Jesus is saying here is that your focus, he's not only restored him and repurposed him, he's refocusing his life and saying, the sole focus of your life as you move forward from this day is to be on me. Follow me. Don't follow John. Don't follow somebody else. Follow me. Follow my direction in your life. Follow the directions that I give you along the way. It's not going to necessarily be an easy life. It's going to be hard at times. And yes, there's a death that will await you. That's a martyr's death that will not be anything enjoyable. But you're going to see great things happen. You're going to see God. You're going to see me work phenomenal things through your life. You're going to see the fulfillment of the promise I made earlier when we met before I died, which said, "After you will do even greater things than I have done through the power of the Holy Spirit." Well, let's wrap this up. What about you? Goes back to the original question that I asked here. Is there a point in your life you've blown it, you've sidelined yourself? You're not in the game anymore. You're not the worst you can be. You're not, you know, having all kinds of addictions. You're not kind of turned to a life of crime over here. You're leading a respectable life. But you're not living up to God's potential life. You're over here. And your life is, well, you're getting through. Sometimes it works, sometimes it's not. I think the message that God has for each one of us today is even when you've given up on your hopes and dreams, God has not given up on you. Even when others have given up on you, God has not given up on you. Even when you've written your life off, God has not written your life off. And by the way, one of the lessons here for us is how often have we written off the lives of others? We look at them and say, they're beyond redemption. My son had all kinds of tattoos. Every time he was back in jail, he got a new set of tattoos. The one that broke my heart the most, and I think the one that he eventually changed his mind about, but he had tattooed on his, I believe on his arm or his lower chest, beyond redemption. See, at one point, he'd given up on himself. And he often told us, if you didn't have any hope for me, I wouldn't have any hope for myself either. How many people do we write off and we say they're beyond redemption, they're beyond hope? When what they really need is somebody to hope for them, to show them that God still has a plan and a purpose for our lives, and that they are never beyond redemption. You see, the whole meaning and significance of the resurrection, the death of Jesus on a cross, as cruel as it was, and the resurrection, is that no failure is final, no sin is final. There is nothing, as long as you are breathing here, that there's nothing that can stand in the way of you having this close relation with God. He invites you back. He welcomes you back. He welcomes you with open arms. He has a purpose for your life. It may change according to how we have lived our lives up to that point. I've lived that out myself. I wouldn't be here today if God didn't restore, repurpose, and refocus lives. And I believe there's some listening in today that wouldn't be here as well. I think there's others listening in here today who experienced different failures in their lives. I'm not going to start mentioning what the possibilities are. You know them. You know yourself. And I think the message that God wants to get through to your heart is that He hasn't given up on you. He has a purpose for your life. He welcomes you into His kingdom, not just as a passenger, not just as an add-on, but as an active part of bringing His kingdom to bear, bringing His kingdom into becoming a reality here on earth. Regardless of who you are, regardless of where you've been, regardless of what you've done or what's been done to you. In God's economy, nobody is beyond redemption. All of us have a purpose and a place, if we're willing to open our hearts up, receive Him into our lives, and then follow Jesus with wholehearted love wherever He leads. We're going to go into communion here in a few minutes. But as we take and share in the communion, what I want you to is to experience that. One is to come to grips with God's great love for you, demonstrated through Jesus, that while we were yet sinners, while we were far from Him, while we had no inclination towards Him, had no desire even for Him, Jesus died for us. And He rose again from the dead to give us this hope, to give us this new life, that when we receive His life into ours, we can begin to experience His transforming work in our lives, that we can experience the fullness of life that He has for us. So which side of the resurrection are you living right now? Is he to live a defeated life, one that has given up on life, regardless of how badly you or I have blown it? Is to live on the other side of the resurrection, not experiencing that life that is ours because Jesus rose from the dead. He didn't stay in the tomb. And so today He invites you, He invites me, He invites us to openly receive the life that He wants to give us, to restore us to that relationship with Him that He would want for us, and ultimately we actually desire to give us a fresh purpose for what our life is all about as followers of Jesus, and to call us to focus on Him as we go through our everyday lives and through the world in which we live, because it's so easy to get distracted. And we share in communion because it's a way of calling us back and renewing that commitment and renewing our sense of who Jesus is in our lives and what He's done for us. And so today, I invite you to take the bread that simply represents the broken body of Jesus, that He took on humanity, He took on human flesh, lived among us, was one of us, died for us, was broken for us, that we might experience wholeness in Him. When we take the bread, we are identifying with His brokenness and His broken body, His brokenness for a broken world. Let's do that together. Then when we take the cup, we recognize that in this cup represents Jesus shed blood. And as He said in that Last Supper with His disciples, this is the blood of the new covenant that I'm establishing with you. And when we take this, we're saying we're entering into that covenant by faith. We're entering into that covenant. Part of going into that covenant is, yes, receiving the freedom of forgiveness that is ours, regardless of where we've been and what we've done and everything past, present, or future. But entering into that covenant also means taking on His purpose for our lives and living out His mission and living our lives regardless of where that takes us, whether it takes us into our regular jobs or calls us to go and leave those things to do something else. But we will live our lives out on mission for Him. So when we take this cup, it has all that significance. May I add here that the bread and the cup sometimes are simply seen as symbols, and they are in many ways. But I believe as we take this part of this together, there's a spiritual transaction that takes place between us and God. When we take place, when we say this from our heart and with a deep-seated faith and conviction and a willing spirit to follow Jesus. With that in mind, let's take this cup together. My prayer for you today is that you would have come into a fresh experience of the amazing love of God your Father. And as you receive that love, you'd also come into a fresh experience of the grace of Jesus, who welcomes you into a relationship with Him, has a purpose for your life, and just calls you to keep walking with keeping one foot in front of the other, with your focus firmly fixed on Him, as He empowers you by His Spirit to follow his leading in the world in which you live every day. May that be true in your life. Can I just add here for a minute? Often when we meet in person, I get to see your faces, I get to talk with you in person a little bit and hear what's taking place in your life. And I got to say, I desperately miss that. I hope, against hope sometimes, that sometime before the end of my time comes here, the end of June, we'll be able at least once again to have one meeting like that where I can see your faces in front of me and I can talk to you in person about what's taking place in your life. But in the meantime, I long to hear from you. So I wish, invite you to email me and just tell me what's taking place in your life. It doesn't have to have anything to do with what we've talked about here. I find most often when people come to talk to me after a service and we pray together, there wasn't always a lot to do with what I had to talk about. I hope God's speaking to your lives through that. But I just want you to know I care about you. I just would love to know what's taking place in your life. May you experience the fullness of the Spirit in your life and experience the love and the joy and the peace that are so much part of that fullness. May you leave here with his blessing and peace.